Looking for Lewis and Clark. Seattle's Morning News. And here he is, Mr. and Felix Bunnell. With Thanksgiving just a week away, that means storm season is here. Classic northwest wind and rain. Served up with stuffing and mashed potatoes. A resident historian reminds us, even Lewis and Clark faced a big November windstorm when they traveled through the southwest part of the state more than 200 years ago. And Felix is brought to us by the King County Library System.
First of all, I don't recommend camping in Pacific County or Wakayakum County in November. But no. If you're Lewis and Clark and President Thomas Jefferson has sent you west and it's November 1805, you don't really have much choice. So from November 10th, November 14th of that year, the explorers were pinned down by a series of storms. The place they were camped is on the Washington side of the Columbia, just east of that Astoria Bridge. This area was where the Megler Ferry Dock was up until 1966 when they built the bridge. And the rest area there was actually renamed from the Megler rest area to Dismal Niche back in 2005. Clark used that phrase, Dismal Niche, to describe the area in his journal. And here's what he wrote about the weather. And he said, the rainy weather continued without a longer intermission than 2 hours at a time from the 5th in the morning until the 16th. 11 days rain and the most disagreeable time I have experienced. So on that day, they moved their campsite farther west to where Fort Canby State Park is now. And that's where they were when a big windstorm hit on November 22nd, 1805. Dave DeCandrey is a Lewis and Clark expert, and he's retired director of the Washington State Historical Society.
But then they got really walloped by this second big storm that apparently, from the reading of the journal accounts, it was more intense. It was more compact and fiercer than the earlier blast, which was the course of 2 or 3 days, but it really, from all accounts, it really howled for virtually 24 hours.
You know, an Oregon meteorologist and author named George Miller wrote that this was most likely one of the strongest storms the party experienced during their stay at the mouth of the Columbia River, and it may have been similar in its track to the infamous Columbus Day storm of October 12, 1962. So this likely meant winds over 60 miles per hour, perhaps way over, and heavy rain, just like the storms that we get once or twice a year, pretty much every autumn and winter. In fact, during that Columbus Day storm, the highest winds of anywhere in the track of that storm, California to BC, were recorded not too far away at Nacelle Ridge, 160 miles per hour, if you can believe it. Wow. Dave DeCandrey says the anecdotal evidence of the storms of 1805 is all there in the expedition journals.
They were pretty colorful, talking about the waves and the sprays carrying inshore from the Columbia River, the branches and the trees cracking in the wind. So you can get a pretty clear picture of just what they, I mean, the waves would toss their canoes around like toothpicks on the shore. So it's pretty descriptive language. You can get a pretty good idea of just what the circumstances were like.
You know, their clothes were tattered from months of travel, and the rain made everything wet, including their blankets, but this was their job. They were, you know, manly men of the Discovery Corps. Dave DeCandrey says the relatively mild temperatures meant that weather-wise, they actually dodged a bullet.
They were in no real trouble. They just simply needed to get to a finishing camp, which later became known as Station Camp. The big one, of course, was Fort Clatsop across the river, founded the next month. But between those storms, that was their closest brush with danger, a cold front, but they didn't really get one.
You know, the main reason the weather was so disagreeable or horrible, as Clark often wrote with his bad misspelling, was, you know, surprise, their stay at the mouth of the Columbia was from November to March.
The coastal region, once they got below where Bonneville Dam is, it rained almost constantly for 3 or 4 months. That left them with a distinctly sour impression of this country, notwithstanding the fact that it was warmer than they might have expected at that latitude. They still got a good regular drenching.
Didn't they just check the forecast before going? I mean, that would seem prudent to me.
You know, we've all heard about that seasonal affective disorder, and most of us have at times found that ceaseless rain a little hard to take. I asked Dave DeCandrey if, beyond that sour impression, the weather ever got to Lewis and Clark from a mental health standpoint.
Well, you know, that's a very good question. I mean, there are episodes in the journey where armchair psychologists have lent a lot of thought. No one's really kind of dwelt on that here. I think in part because in my own recollection of the journals, there's no nugget or bits of text one can seize upon to indicate that they were demoralized in any sense. I mean, after all, in effect, they had just accomplished the mission.
Yeah, and they'd arrived a little late because there was a chance of rendezvousing with a ship, so they could have sent all their specimens back to D.C. and maybe gotten some more blankets or some less tattered clothes, but they were too late for that. You know, and they did have a little snow at Fort Clatsop in early 1806. But all in all, it was kind of a fairly typical autumn and winter northwest weather 214 years ago. You know, and the earlier explorers upon whom they based some of their research, like Cook, Vancouver, and Gray, those guys were smart and timed their visits from anywhere between March and May. And when Vancouver was here, the weather was so great, he wrote like Chamber of Commerce level material about how wonderful this place will be for civilization.
Check the forecast.
Yes, yeah, exactly.
They were smarter. How did they get how would they get messages back? I mean, they were incommunicado, so how would they even coordinate a pickup by ship?
Well, no, they knew that this area was already relatively populated with trading vessels on certain times of year already by 1805. A lot of people don't realize that. They think this is just this, you know, the wilderness other than the native population, but Europeans had been visiting here for since 1778. So this was like, we were 20 years or so, 20 plus years.
Wait a minute. They walked all the way across the country and they got there and said, darn, we could have taken a ship.
Exactly. I don't know what they were thinking, but it's all, I blame Thomas Jefferson, as we blame him for so many things.
Historian Felix Bonnell, who you can hear every Wednesday on Seattle's Morning News, all his features at MyNorthwest.com. Watching CNN and Fox in the studio here, we're watching their graphics, and on CNN it says, Sondland, yes, there was a quid pro quo. And on Fox, it says, Sondland, President Trump never told me directly aid was tied to announcement of investigations. And the question is, who's right? Well, as we learned, if you listen to the whole testimony, as we just did here, both can be true. It depends on which quid and which pro quo you're talking about. So what Sondland testified, to summarize, is that, yes, there was a quid pro quo. The equation was here that in return for the president of Ukraine simply announcing there would be a, quote, investigation, without too many specifics about what it was, he would get a meeting with President Trump at the White House. All right? What's in question is whether the military aid to Ukraine, which was on hold, was also linked to that. And Gordon Sondland was very specific about that. He said, I don't recall President Trump talking about any security assistance ever. But he also said that he, Gordon Sondland, was convinced that the aid was part of the equation, even though the president himself never said that. So, of course, we're trying to get into what was actually in the president's head at the time. And it hasn't been easy. Sondland said that the aid was my own guess. But as the Democratic counsel Daniel Goldman tried to point out, there's a lot of evidence that, in fact, that aid was conditioned. And it goes back to President Trump's original position on Ukraine, going back to many months ago, when it was very clear that the president did not trust Ukraine because of the corruption going on there. Now, again, when we talk about corruption, what does that mean? Is that code for the general reputation Ukraine had as being a corrupt place where public officials would do things simply for their own benefit, whether or not benefited the nation? Or was corruption a code word for Hunter Biden being on the board of Burisma? It's also acknowledged that Burisma, this natural gas company, was itself part of the overall corruption. But again, what we have here is people hearing the same conversation but interpreting the various words differently. Sometimes not at face value, sometimes looking at them as code words. So I guess you could say that the testimony so far this morning benefits both sides, because Democrats can point to, he said there was a quid pro quo, and the Republicans can say, well, he also said Trump never himself talked about it. And that's why we will, when we get back to the testimony, we will hear the Republicans asking these same questions of Gordon Sondland and seeing if they can get answers more suited to them. On the quid pro quo, here is part of the of Mr. Sondland's opening statement where he tackles that very issue.
I know that members of this committee frequently frame these complicated issues in the form of a simple question. Was there a quid pro quo? As I testified previously, with regard to the requested White House call and the White House meeting, the answer is yes. Mr. Giuliani conveyed to Secretary Perry, Ambassador Volker, and others that President Trump wanted a public statement from President Zelensky committing to investigations of Burisma and the 2016 election. Mr. Giuliani expressed those requests directly to the Ukrainians, and Mr. Giuliani also expressed those requests directly to us. We all understood that these prerequisites for the White House call and the right White House meeting reflected President Trump's desires and requirements.
But again, he says he never heard the president say in so many words, the aid is contingent on this announcement of an investigation from the president of Ukraine. He also went to great pains to point out that he is not a note taker and that the State Department was not cooperating in providing any records to help him refresh his memory, which was a big point among the Democrats. But at the same time, he resented the idea that he was part of any sort of rogue operation involving Mr. Giuliani. In fact, he said he did not appreciate Mr. Giuliani's involvement at all, but at the same time was careful to communicate at all times what Giuliani had told him, what actions he was taking. In other words, there are records there, but he just does not have access to them right now because the State Department won't allow it. Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News. I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. Thanks for listening to the show's podcast. We're happy you're here.
And you can keep up with the show and find some of the stories from today online at MyNorthWest.com.